must be. Yeah, it's difficult. my MacBook, it's like 4.5 years old now, and it's still running pretty well, but it has some weird habits now. Yeah. My absolute favorite one is the fact that you can charge it like to 100%, and then sometimes when you turn it on, it still says you've got no battery left. you have to plug it in before it'll work. But it doesn't do this with any consistency. It's totally random.
Oh my god, it's so quirky. Anyway.
Yeah. So that's fun.
You should just be part of Creators for Change. And then irresponsibly invest money in a new laptop.
Yeah, that sounds like a possibility. On that bombshell, are you already recording?
Yes.
Okay. Are you ready to begin?
I have been for 7.5 minutes.
That's good. Okay. Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. My name's Jimmy and I voted leave in the...
Is that what we're calling it now? The bah! Because I'm down for changing the name.
I might, yeah. It might just... Yeah. Leave in the bar in the thing.
Brexit is now being renamed. Ah!
I forgot if I'm supposed to say June 2016 or it was in June, wasn't it? I think.
It was in one of the J anymore. Months.
It's just too much has happened. There's been too much news in the intervening 2 years.
My brain has already suppressed all of the memories.
Yes. So anyway, I voted leave in the. in 2016. Jazza, do you want to introduce yourself?
Oh, yes, my introduction. This is going very smoothly. I'm Jazza, and I, as an arch Ramona, of course, joined the 700,000 people marching in London last week, or 2 weeks ago, recently. My placard, I'm not usually a sign person, but this time I thought I'd push the boat out. My placard was really quite brilliant, got... 2 compliments on the whole march. It was very, really good. And it read, "We've all put the kettle on and then decided we actually didn't want a tea. We'll pass on the cuppa this time, Teresa." Open brackets. "In this metaphor, putting the kettle on is Article 50. Brexit is the cup of tea. And Theresa May is the well-meaning hostess trying to force hot liquid down our throats." And then there was a picture of, like, a kettle and all of the steam formed into Theresa May's face. And I was very proud of it. I ended up with a lot of people.
That's a short novel, that's not a placard.
No, but that was kind of the point. It was meant to be funny. Do you get it?
I get it.
I had lots of people just kind of staring at me, reading my sign, and then saying, "That was a bit long, wasn't it?" And I was like, "Yes, I noticed, I wrote it." I voted Remain, lol.
Yes, yeah, you did. I mean, do you actually think that on balance people do want Brexit to be cancelled? Because I've definitely seen polling that contradicts that.
I can't speak for the nation, Jimmy. Unfortunately, I haven't been given that privilege. I'd quite like Brexit to be cancelled. So, there.
Okay, well, we can talk about that a little bit later. The first topic is actually going to be, I mean, we do free topics, as our listeners will know. The first topic is going to be discussing the march. And also more recently, this investigation into Aaron Banks, who is one of the self-proclaimed bad boys of Brexit.
Yeah, and he's a slimy bastard.
Do you want to give the intro as to what Banks has been up to?
So he is one of the principal donors of kind of like the official Brexit campaign. He's also the director of Leave.eu, which is the more unsavoury kind of like branch of the like Brexiteers kind of like organisations. He is currently under investigation because the Electoral Commission isn't sure where he... how much did he give? It was like £8 million.
£8 million,
yeah. And they're like, "We hasn't really seen evidence as to where this money comes from. We would like to investigate where you got it, Mr. Banks, just to make sure that you aren't using foreign money to pay for British elections," which, by the way, is very, very illegal.
Mm. So he's effectively kind of accused of not electoral fraud in the sense of having, you know, taken a ballot that wasn't his, but in cheating in the campaign.
Yes,
basically.
Exactly. From financing. And the big fear is, and the big thing that a lot of some of the more erratic Remainers would probably put forward is that he got the money from the Russians, which is like a nice, fun thing, because Russia quite likes it when Western democracies are flailing a little bit, and God knows that Brexit is making the UK flail. But he is a really slimy dick, and when it got announced that he was under investigation, he tweeted a selfie of him in Bermuda.
He did, yeah.
Saying that he had gone fishing.
Yeah, he did. I heard, since you mentioned Remainers, the journalist Peter Jukes, who some time ago did actually appear on this podcast, tweeted that only 1 in 50 people would have to have been swayed by online advertising, which is all kind of wrapped up in this thing about dodgy Leave campaign money.
Mm-hmm. Is that referring to kind of like the Cambridge Analytica stuff?
Yeah, kind of that. And it's only 1 in 50 people would have had to been swayed by, you know, some of the Leave campaign's online advertising to, you know, swing the result of the referendum. And 1 in 50 is quite a lot of people, mm-hmm. really. You know.
Yeah, I mean, it's about a million people.
Well, it's a lot of people in a campaign like this. A lot of people would have had to change their minds based on online advertising, which mm-hmm, I think, mm-hmm, as mm-hmm. most people who use online advertising would be able to tell you, it's not really that effective.
yeah,
exactly. I mean, that would be quite a good. If 1 in 50 people see your advert, bought your product, that would be amazing for most online advertisers.
No, but it's slightly different in because you're not convincing somebody to buy a product. You're convincing somebody to everyone, like that a person will probably vote, and then you're trying to make them decide which way they're going to vote. So they're going to vote probably anyway, and then you're trying to get them to decide either way. So I'm not sure I agree with that kind of analogy.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is slightly different. I do agree, although I think even that said, 1 in 50 is still quite ambitious for a you know, any advertising campaign.
Yeah. Anyway, Jimmy, we are still in the introduction.
We are still in the introduction. So second up, are we discussing Waitrose or are we discussing the police?
Make that call, Jimmy. Go. I give you that responsibility.
We're gonna discuss Waitrose. Do you shop at Waitrose, Jazza?
Yeah.
Oh my God, you're incredibly middle class.
I am. And, no, I was about to say that I'm proud of it, and I'm not sure it's really possible to be proud of being middle class. It's either a Sainsbury's local or a Waitrose near me. And okay. Waitrose is actually cheaper, so I do go to Waitrose.
Oh my gosh!
I know.
Okay, this is even more of a shocking revelation. The story we're actually about to discuss. so basically, the editor of Waitrose Food, which is the it is one of those free magazines that's given out as public relations material. Basically, it's just a effectively large amount of advertising.
My mum loves it. Lots of really nice photography.
Yeah, photography, recipes, that sort of thing. Anyway, the editor of Waitrose Food, William Sitwell, responded to a email from a potential freelancer. The freelancer wanted to do a series on vegan food, basically, and he responded by suggesting that they do a piece on killing vegans one by one. That is a direct quote. Mm-hmm. The actual quote gets quite graphic, and you know, obviously this was not intended seriously, but he's ended up resigning over the matter after, you know, the emails were publicized,
and obviously this is an affront to freedom of speech, and it is the lefty liberal snowflakes once again descending on a poor man's job and getting him fired.
Yes, and the other stance, which I guess Jazza implied with his slightly snarky reading there, was is that actually this guy was an arsehole to somebody who was a potential part-time worker or a potential freelancer. He was an arsehole to them, and he made Waitrose look bad, and so Waitrose decided to push him, or he decided to go voluntarily, which seems less likely. But
I'm not sure that I have the opinion that you think I have, Jimmy, so this will be an interesting conversation.
Oh. Ooh. Right back at you. Yeah. Okay, and the other topic the last topic that we're going to do also concerns rude comments made over the internet, or somewhat concerns it.
tentative link there, Jimmy.
Tentative. Well, you know, you have to try. Yeah. So earlier this week, Sarah Thornton, who is the chair of the National Police Chiefs Councils, so a top police officer basically, said that the police should focus their resources more on things like burglary and violent crime instead of incidents of misogyny. And she specifically used the phrase non-crime hate incidents or non-crime incidents.
And returning to kind of traditional values when it came to the police force, which a lot of people have kind of hated, even though it's just really semantics.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, it's this kind of this old thing that always comes up when people discuss you know, policemen or police forces, bobbies on the beat rather than people sitting at home monitoring what's going on Twitter, or at least that seems to have been the way that this has all been interpreted.
Right, cool.
So we're going to discuss that, I guess, just in the context of, you know, policing of social media.
Yeah, and, essentially, Jimmy's going to try and explain to me why I should stop caring about being hate-crimed. So that's fun.
That's not fair, but let's just run with that anyway.
All right, let's play some music and then ask politely for money.
If you enjoy this podcast and want to throw some money at us, you can do so by going to patreon.com/rightdishonourable, where you'll find all the details you need to do so. We also have an Audible referral link that you can access by going to audible.com/rightdishonourable or audible.co.uk/rightdishonourable. Thanks very much to our current list of patrons. This includes David Warner, Emerson Spartz, Gemma Cumming, John O, Matt and Ollie McGregor. So, Jazza, what exactly was the point of 700,000 Remain voters taking to the streets several weeks ago? It was now, and probably longer by the time people are actually listening to it. What did this actually achieve in tangible terms?
So I kind of resent being asked these kinds of questions because
That's why I asked.
Yeah. Well, you're very kind. I actually got asked it by a journalist on the route. And I was like, the point here is not, like, the march itself does not change anything specifically just by being a march, but it is a really important act in terms of kind of animating the people who are there, those who are more likely to go back home and be activists. It is really kind of important for, like, that kind of morale side of stuff. It also proves that there are an awful lot of people who are willing to sacrifice their weekends and then descend on London in order to show that they are not happy. It gives like Remain kind of like curious members of Parliament the ability to lean on that as kind of like a symbolic act that has shown that there is an appetite for there to be a second referendum. And it gets
Does it show
headlines.
That,
yeah, I mean, if they'd had it and like a couple of dozen thousand people turned up, then it would have been a huge blow to the call for a second referendum, and it probably would have then fizzled out and never happened. But the fact that they got four times the number of people that they'd actually expected, and that the campaign who were organising it had kind of projected. When they had told the police, like 700,000 people marched. It's the second largest kind of like protest and march in the history of the UK.
The first one being the anti-Iraq war demonstration.
Yeah, which went really well.
Successful demonstration.
Yeah, very successful demonstration.
I
knew that you were going to bring this up, you cheeky little so-and-so. So what the Iraq war did do, the Iraq war protest did do, is it showed and it voiced what ended up being a kind of like key point in the narrative and like the story of the UK of that time. Like, we now talk about the Iraq war as this huge kind of like error that the United Kingdom kind of like took part in. Tony Blair is still held personally responsible for all of the atrocities that happened in Iraq and how poorly it was managed. And then that protest is often shown as the people knowing best, and of the of kind of like the people having like not desiring to be part of this.
I'd have to double check this, but I'm confident that if the opinion polling at the time suggested that the majority were in favour of the Iraq War at the time,
irrespective of how many people marched. But in terms of being on what side of history, has that ended up kind of like deciding when we think about like the narrative of the UK in the early 2000s? That is seen as kind of like this example of the people, of those who protested getting it right. And there was kind of... It, like, it almost doesn't matter if there isn't a second referendum, because all of the people there were kind of like, well, we showed that this was... like, it was a big enough story to show that there is not this kind of, like, consensus in the UK about leaving the European Union. There still is kind of, like, this desire for it to either not happen or for it to involve the British public once again. And that's kind of why it's there. It's there for symbolism. It's not there... We didn't, like, march on that day in order to kind of, like, expect Theresa May to come out of Downing Street and then that, well, you've all made a very compelling argument, guys. Let's call it off. Like,
I feel some of the figureheads of the march, which I don't think we actually explicitly said, but it was organised to get the second referendum, i.e. so-called people's vote...
as you like to call it, a second people's vote. I do like that, Jimmy. I think that was very clever.
Second people's vote, loser's vote.
Yeah.
Best, the second.
No, keep them coming. Hit me with it. Hit me.
The figureheads of the people's vote movement. They all.
Shall I tell you who I saw? Who was there, like marching at the front? Because I was quite
Alistair
near the
Campbell.
Front. So Alistair Campbell was there. I mean, Bay, isn't he? He's like this great unifying figure. There's also Kevin Bacon. Not Kevin Bacon. What's his name? The guy who used to be a Blue Peter presenter and now like presents
Richard
Drive
Bacon?
Time. Richard Bacon. Who, as you
Bacon.
All know, yeah, Kevin Bacon was there trying to sell us like a broadband plan. Richard Bacon was there, who is obviously most famous for being fired off of Blue Peter for taking cocaine. There was Chuka Amuna, who, like everybody loves, obviously, tried to run for the leadership against Jeremy Corbyn and then went, no, private life. And kind of like a load of other...
It's a gallery of rogues at the front
of
this march.
Oh, a gallery of positive rogues. Oh, there was also Eddie Izzard. He was there with his nice EU-painted nails. Very classy.
Very classy, yeah.
So, they are this great figurehead, unifying figures, who really do cross... political and ideological boundaries in terms of their appeal, and it was really fantastic to be marching behind them.
Are you being sarcastic?
Obviously.
I can't tell if you're being sarcastic.
Obviously.
Okay.
Obviously. That is one of the weakest things about like the movement for a people's vote is the people who is the people. It's those who have ended up being most associated with it, including specifically people like Alistair Campbell and like Tony Blair, all of these kind of like dinosaurs who are incredibly divisive on their own. I don't really quite feel the same way about that when it comes to somebody like John Major. I think I actually quite like him as somebody from who was a Conservative Prime Minister. And
John Major is a classic retired politician who, in hindsight, people look at him and seem to go, oh, it doesn't seem so bad now. But he spent most of his premiership actually defending
having a terrible
Alston,
time,
didn't he?
Yeah, having a terrible time, bless him.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, the reason that those people emerged as figureheads is obviously that they get media coverage and they get those media slots.
Yeah, and that is the media's fault.
It is, I mean, yeah, just basically the fault of how the media works.
But,
I mean, Alistair Campbell is kind of an interesting example in this because obviously he was at the centre of the Iraq controversy.
Mm-hmm.
And He did this interview with Andrew Neil on This Week, or The Week, which appears after Question Time.
Yeah, a week.
I can't remember. I think it's This Week.
Some week.
And just the hypocrisy in his stance was just so evident.
How so? I didn't see it. What did he say?
Well, just in the sense that, you know, there was the anti-Iraq war march, which was ignored, basically.
Yeah, this is precisely why he shouldn't be rolled out to defend the march.
I don't think he should, no. But he just seems to have this attitude, which I think is redolent of a lot of the people's vote figureheads, that he knows better and therefore the vote, the referendum results should be voided. Which I just think is... I'm not surprised coming from Campbell, because I don't think he's a particularly pleasant guy, but it just seems disgraceful, to be honest with you. And I don't necessarily think everyone who marched feels that way, but it does kind of morally taint the whole effort, I think.
I tell you what, it's my fault for bringing them up, but it was, as somebody who wants, who thinks there should be the people should be asked again, a second referendum, call it what you want, were our semantics. Mm. But like asking people again, I think was really important. But it's very difficult when you're kind of like, when you're doing a podcast and like not all of your friends are as politically engaged as you, and you're chatting down the pub. But being there and seeing kind of all of these other people, so there was a huge number of people from all across the UK. There were a lot of like sponsored buses that brought people in, and in that way it was very similar to the Iraq war. It was very deliberately kind of being coordinated so that it didn't just look like a load of London liberal elites who were coming down, even though it was incredibly white. It was very, very old, and it was mainly like
surprising.
Families and stuff.
Was it older than you expected?
Yeah, big time. I was in kind of like the group of people that I was marching with. I was the youngest by like 20 years. It was pretty insane. And because of that, because of this weird kind of demographic that had turned out for this protest, it was more just kind of like a walk rather than a march. Like we were trying to do a load of like chants and stuff. Nobody was joining in. No one at all. The queue for like the Marks and Spencer's food that we passed, they had to close down because there were too many people trying to go in to get a G&T in one of those little cans. It was a really odd atmosphere. But I guess that's what happens when you get non-activists to march. They just make a sign that they think is quite witty, put on some sensible shoes, and just walk.
Yeah. I mean, older people are more engaged in politics generally, so I guess it shouldn't be that surprising.
They are more likely to vote. I'm not sure you can call that engaged with politics. Can you? I don't know. It depends how you define it.
I think they're probably more engaged across the board, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. I don't know. We'd have to look into that, I guess. I mean, that does surprise me, because I thought it would be predominantly younger people, like people in their 20s.
No, it was like old people, young families. I saw actually very few like younger people, younger activists and stuff like that. And that was like really, really notable actually.
Did you, before the march actually took place, there was a bit of online marketing around it involving a kid, who'd been videoed by his dad or mum saying how, this was like a 5-year-old kid, how they were going down to the march and, you know, sort of saying pro-EU things. Mm-hmm. Did you actually see that?
No, I didn't.
You didn't.
Did you hate it?
It's weird that people...
The use of kids as, like, political
kids.
Props.
Yeah, that's odd, isn't it?
That makes me feel uncomfortable as well. Like, if/when I have kids, I'll take my kids on marches. I think that's a brilliant experience for them to have. But using them as a political prop... is a little bit icky, and I wouldn't be that into it. But we are in the age of kind of like mummy and daddy bloggers, aren't we? Where people are now millionaires off of their children being cute on camera. So I guess it's just kind of like a part of our society now.
It is odd. Should we turn to the matter of Aaron Banks, since I feel we've somewhat exhausted the march itself?
I do have one thing to kind of call you up on. You and I had a little bit of Barney on Twitter, didn't we? Oh God, you didn't shut up.
I try and insult you as much as possible on Twitter.
Oh, I know. You're basically my troll following me around. It's a nightmare. And I can't block you because we've got this bloody podcast to do.
You're acting as though it's all one-sided here.
Yeah.
This is a mutually abusive relationship.
Which makes it fine. But you were like, oh yeah, and actually quite a lot of people on your side of the argument were like, oh yeah, do you remember how many people voted for Brexit? And it's like 17 million. It's like, oh yeah, and how many people marched? 700,000. Yeah, well, there's your answer then, shut up. And I just, do you genuinely think that that is an appropriate comparison? Because you're comparing apples and oranges there, surely.
Well, you could say that in a lot of ways it does take much more effort to go to a march than it does to go out to a polling booth on one day, which is, you know, just a couple of blocks from your house usually.
Yeah.
So in that sense, no. But I agree with you that the marches do tend to solidify the bonds between campaigners,
yes.
And that is a function of them that's noticeable when you actually go down and observe these things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The thing is that in terms of like the news cycle, in the terms of how the march was being discussed and what the figureheads were saying, it was being used as a way of saying, look, people want another vote. They want the first vote in which they'll be fully informed, was the line used, which was terribly unconvincing. But that is what people were saying. And in that context, saying 17.4 million is a bigger number than 700,000 is valid. That was the context in which people
People weren't saying that. Those are comparing two different things. And what I think...
The entire march was predicated on the idea that there needs to be another vote. So saying, no,
yes,
there doesn't need to be another
enough,
vote.
Funnily enough,
and
Jimmy,
this is why.
We couldn't get 17 million people to block out their Saturday and come down.
Well, like, no, because probably 17... Probably, you know, far less than even 10 million people think that there should be another vote.
Yes,
you
no,
know,
probably,
if,
but
as,
but
as
what,
I said at the
but,
outset,
but, what,
if you look at the
does,
polling, if you look at the polling, the majority of people, when you include Remainers who've accepted the result, have accepted the result, and they do think Brexit should take place.
But very very often you end up hearing the argument that these are kind of like a load of elites in London who are just trying to screw with things, who don't trust, who are anti-democratic and all of those kinds of things.
Alistair Campbell is an anti-democrat.
Yeah,
I
know.
But
there weren't 700,000 Alistair Campbell clones walking on that Saturday.
All of the figureheads you could fairly label as anti-democrats, perhaps with the exception of Chuka Amuna. I don't know about him.
Oh,
but...
and John Major. Go on, like him. You know you
Yeah, I do sort of like John Major. I mean, in some ways I find Alistair Campbell quite entertaining, even though I think he's probably a bad man in, you know, moral terms.
But the point of this march isn't to say, here are the people who are going to vote for who want there to be a second referendum. Here are all of them. We brought them all here. There they are, sorted.
It was for a second referendum, though.
Yeah, but
it?
The point is to show that those people exist and what those
we
people
We know
look
you
like.
Exist. You appear
no,
in polling.
No,
I could have told you that these people existed
they
beforehand.
Yeah, you could have, but it's used as a rhetoric of like, who even are these people? No, but like the country has decided. No, the country hasn't decided. A ton of them have just turned out for the second largest protest in British history.
Well, no, people still disagree, but the country as a whole has decided. The decision has been made.
You cannot have consensus. We're in a state of constant agonism. It's okay that we haven't just made up our mind.
This is not a consensual decision. This is a decision that has been made based on a simple majority vote.
Yeah, then maybe. You know, then maybe.
This is not
be asked again just to make sure.
No, we don't do that. But like, we would not be being asked again if we'd voted Remain. And you know that, I know that, everyone knows that. You know, it would have been the end of the argument, basically.
I mean, they say, but they keep on talking about another referendum in Scotland, though, don't they?
They do, but even that's not going particularly well for the SNP.
No, is it?
And also, the SNP are in government in Scotland, and Leave. I mean, there's not been a Leave Prime Minister for. Not even Thatcher counts, because she actually only really turned against the EU after she left office.
Mm-hmm. One of those XMPs throwing their weight around.
Towards the end, but she certainly, for most of her premiership, didn't campaign as a proto-Leave voter, or whatever you want to call it.
Well, I'm quite happy with this conversation, because I managed to make you go squeaky. Shall we talk about Waitrose now?
Should we touch on Aaron Banks? We said we would.
Oh, right, yeah, sure, Aaron Banks.
So, obviously, we can't say whether Aaron Banks actually did channel money from Russians or whoever else into the
Can I just say? Wouldn't surprise me if he had.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he doesn't appear to be the we're sort of vaguely just attacking his character. He doesn't seem to be the best guy, I think. No, it's fair to say.
No, I would say actually I prefer Alistair Campbell over Aaron Banks any day.
I guess so, but I mean, you know, I don't know if we actually caught this remark when we were recording, but Aaron Banks did tweet at Alistair Campbell after the investigation was announced. At least I didn't, you know, order someone to be killed, referring to David Kelly, who died during the run-up to the Iraq War, mm-hmm. Over his doubts about WMDs, I think it was.
The dodgy dossier.
And you know, you could well argue that given how the occupation of Iraq went down after the war, and that Alistair Campbell has actually caused a lot more human damage than Aaron Banks ever will.
Yeah, but at least he comes off as less of a dick.
Does he though? I think they're both. I mean, Alistair Campbell. He might be lovely to his kids or whatever, but he does come off as a mm-hmm. bit of a cunt, frankly.
Mm-hmm. So as a representative for the 52%, Jimmy.
Yes.
How do you take like offence to this investigation taking place? Do you think that it's just a way of kind of like Ramona's and the obviously biased electoral commission trying to thwart the voice of the people?
So I will answer your question, but I am going to back up a tiny bit. The Electoral Commission, which regulates, in probably quite a loose sense of the word, British elections, referred Aaron Banks to the National Crime Agency after they were unconvinced where the £8 million had come from that he channeled into Leave.eu. The Electoral Commission, it should be pointed out, gave erroneous advice to vote Leave. Regarding their own funding, and then it's tried to fine them for it, but then the High Court actually said you fucked up and gave them the wrong advice. So I think it's fair to say that the EU referendum in general has not been
a
glowing period for the Electoral Commission, and I think the fact that Aaron Banks is being investigated by the National Crime Agency, which is effectively Britain's FBI. For those who haven't heard of it before.
Ooh, cool.
You know, it should be viewed in that context. I've forgotten what the question was.
Does that make it more serious though, because it's being taken on by the National Crime Agency?
Yeah, it does make it more serious. Mm-hmm. I think. But
and does that kind of take away a lot of this noise around this being an attempt to thwart Brexit?
I don't think that, you know, the National Crime Agency is motivated, or even the Electoral Commission for that matter, is motivated by some animus towards the referendum result and is trying to thwart it. I think there's a lot of commentators and a lot of campaigners around this who are trying to thwart the referendum result. I'd name Carol Cadwallader.
Carol Cadwallader, she's a nightmare.
Who's the Guardian journalist around this, and who... You know, even though she was the one who was it Chris Wiley, the
the one with the pink hair.
Yeah. She's been involved in a lot of journalism questioning what's been going on, and particularly, you know, referring to online advertising and that sort of thing. And she's posted some erroneous stuff, and she's come off frankly as a bit of a crank, and just a bit of an obsessive around all of this. And I'm not saying that all of what she's saying is wrong, but I think that
I would say that it's fair to be obsessive, but the fact that she basically ended up saying that all targeted advertising is evil was just kind of so... She was working backwards from the conclusion that there was wrongdoing, and that, I think, showed bad journalism.
Yeah, I don't think she's covered herself in glory throughout this entire thing, even if some of her findings have been valuable. But it would take quite a long time separate the two, I think. Mm-hmm. And she definitely drank the Kool-Aid while speaking to Wiley, I think.
I mean, she may not have covered herself in glory. I'm trying to segue here into the Waitrose story, is that right?
I mean, what I guess I'm saying is that whether or not Aaron Banks is found guilty of what exactly he's accused of, I don't think it undermines the referendum results. Because Leave.eu wasn't the main campaign force, and at any rate, the Remain campaign massively outspent the Leave campaigns. Aggregates.
But we were saying this earlier amongst ourselves. That isn't the point. The point is that there isn't kind of like a clear trail of where the money that Aaron Banks donated came from, and I think that is a really important thing that
he should be investigated, and if he should be charged if the police have sufficient reason to charge him. He should be convicted if there's sufficient evidence to convict him. It doesn't have wider implications, I don't think.
Though I think you are right that often it ends up getting like, because there was potential wrongdoing with Leave.eu and the Leave campaign in general, when it came to campaign financing, they like that often gets framed or interpreted by Remainers like myself as the Leave campaign overspent, like spent more than Remain, and that is an important thing that we acknowledge, that that actually wasn't the case. Remain spent an awful lot, God knows what on, though, because it didn't work very bloody well, did it?
One sideboard before we do move on. Aaron Banks will be being interviewed by Andrew Marr on his Sunday show. In relation to the allegations against him, Aaron Banks hasn't been charged with anything, and if he had been charged, he wouldn't be being interviewed because of rules around court process in the UK. Some Remain commentators are very upset, including Andrew Adonis, who's one of the figureheads of the People's Vote movement, about the fact he's being, quote, given a platform by the Andrew Marr show. How do you feel about it?
I don't think it's the smartest idea to have somebody who's just been announced as being under investigation on a TV show like that to kind of essentially plead their case. And the fact that he might end up being charged with something, I think that feels a little bit icky and a little bit irresponsible, to be completely honest. I know that there are journalistic rules around it, and it's actually kind of like fine. Like on paper it's fine, but it still feels really ick.
Thing is, if people phoned him up for a quote or something, or people have done stories around what he said in response, that's fine. So in a way, I don't actually see what the difference is. One happens to be a slightly longer interview and one would just be a couple of quotes,
but then it allows people to kind of have the trial in their heads in front of them on the TV, and that could undermine any kind of, if there is a trial or if there is kind of like an actual prosecution from the crime agency, then that could really undermine any decisions that they come to, because people who watch this may end up feeling like they have a better expertise because they saw him get interviewed once, and they could be like, oh yeah, you seem like a good bloke.
People do that anyway, though, don't they? They come to our doesn't matter how many restrictions you have around it. So should we talk about Waitrose now?
Waitrose? How do you pronounce it? How do you pronounce it?
Waitrose.
Waitrose, that is correct. My mum calls it Waitrose, like as in, like Waitrose, like as if you're telling your mate Rose to like hold on a sec. And apparently that's the posh way of saying it.
Waitrose, like that.
Waitrose. Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Whereas we pronounce it common, Jimmy.
Common. We are nothing else but common. I've rearranged the words wrongly there.
We're two like white guys with a podcast. We are very common. So the editor of Waitrose Food Magazine, that freebie that your mum picks up when she goes and does the shopping,
if you're posh like Jazza,
if you're posh like me, is standing down because he sent out an email.
He has stood down. He stood down with immediate effect on Halloween.
Oh, love it. Ooh, spooky.
And William Sitwell is his name.
Will he come back? Will he come back from the dead? But he responded in an email to a freelance journalist called Celine Nelson, saying that she should write a piece about killing vegans one by one, because he didn't like the idea that she had pitched to him about some vegan cooking. This was deemed as inappropriate by Waitrose. It was leaked by BuzzFeed, and I'm not sure if this would have necessarily resulted in him being asked to leave his job if there hadn't kind of been this. I mean, it's not really investigative reporting, is it? But kind of like this leaked journalism to BuzzFeed. Mm-hmm. Well, you have quite a nuanced opinion of this, Jimmy. Do go ahead.
So I think it's kind of, you know, what he said in an email to a freelancer who was pitching for work, he just acted like an arsehole, and then, you know, the press exposed him as behaving like an arsehole and also seemingly behaving quite aggressively towards veganism as a concept. You can say that he was joking, but I think the joke was intended to take the piss out of vegans. And he's the editor of a food magazine for a company that wants to sell food to vegans. I mean, among other people, they don't purely sell food to vegans, but you know, they do sell food specifically targeted towards vegans. And he's effectively...
Oh yeah, they just had a of all vegan range get released two weeks ago, didn't they? That's hilarious. It's very expensive and not very good.
And although we are talking about this guy as a journalist, you know, he's actually effectively a content writer, like a commercial content writer, or do you know what I mean? He's more in the realm of public relations than he is in the realm of journalism.
Right, yes, I understand that. And he works for like the Waitrose Free Mag and is like, rather than being a journalist, he's a copywriter for Waitrose.
Yeah, or a copy editor or whatever. I mean, it's not like he's working for an independent food magazine that has no affiliation to any, you know, no commercial affiliation to any actual food producers.
Yeah,
you know,
he literally has the word Waitrose on the front of the magazine.
If we were talking about, say, you know, a marketing chief or like, you know, chief marketing officer who'd basically, you know, said to somebody that they should kill all vegans and then the email had been leaked, you could say, well, the email shouldn't have been leaked, but nobody would be surprised if that person had ended up fired. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? And that's really all that's happened, basically. Mm-hmm.
Can I get you to declare your bias, Jimmy?
Yeah, probably. What is this bias?
You also don't eat meat. Did you?
I'm a vegetarian.
I know, shock horror. I mean, yeah. I'm sure everyone listening was thinking that it was going to be me.
Although I do occasionally dabble, actually.
Do you dabble in bacon every now and again?
Non-vegetarian food.
It possible that you feel this way because it's a personal affront to your people?
No, I actually think vegans are really fucking annoying. I kind of agree with him. I agree with his general sentiment that a lot of vegans
should be killed one by one, to be very clear.
No. But, you know, the gist of his, you know, animus against vegans, I'm like, I mean, I sort of think that vegans are morally correct. I just think that a lot of them are dicks about it. Mm-hmm.
Most of the vegans that I know are very, very nice.
Yes.
So I don't know if he should have lost his job.
Yeah. See, normally I'm the free speech warrior who's saying, like, this is an outrage against civilization or whatever, but we've actually reversed positions for some reason.
I know. I mean, it's clearly because my right to eat meat, it feels like it's been attacked by this. I feel like this is a classic kind of example. Like, he sent an unprofessional email.
I should say, I think an apology would have been enough. I'm just not, like, I think Waitrose had every right to fire him. I don't necessarily think they should have done, but I'm not that offended that they did, if that makes sense.
I think that it's an overreaction that they did, and I think that this is a classic example of context collapse where he's tried to say like a witty joke
to somebody that he thought was really funny. It would have probably come across very differently if he was saying it verbally, but the fact that it was sent to somebody who was outside of kind of like his group, who was a freelance journalist, it was unprofessional. It was a silly thing to send, but he obviously didn't mean that that everybody should kill vegans. Like, that's just, like, that's obviously not what he meant. And the reason that he's been asked to step down is because Waitrose is making a beeline for the vegan market. They literally released this new line of like all vegan pizzas, which are weird, like a couple of weeks ago. And if that, like, perhaps if it were like slightly different, if it hadn't been leaked to, if this had come out at a different time, if this hadn't been leaked to BuzzFeed and been made kind of like a big deal of, then this guy would probably still have his job. He should have apologized. Like, it's a silly thing to send to like a freelancer who you're corresponding with.
By the way, this was the first contact between the two of them as well. This wasn't a freelancer he had a previous relationship or, you know. A previous working relationship.
So you can imagine if you had the word banter feels tainted now, to be completely honest. But if you were sending this kind of an email to somebody in the office who you had like office banter with, then it would be fine. It would probably be seen as a joke. If you were kind of like slightly offended by that, you'd be able to tell them, hey, maybe don't suggest killing a whole food group. A whole food group? Vegans are a food group. They sit at the top of the food pyramid. You should eat about as many vegans as you do have fats and vegetables. I think it's I'm Jimmy this time. That's weird.
Well, you think? I sort of agree. It was an overreaction. My main point was, I don't think this is an affront to free speech or whatever. You know, this is an instance of somebody getting fired for unprofessional conduct that embarrassed their employer. And I do think your point though about, you know, context collapse is correct though, because the way this will have come across to some people is very different from the way he intended it to come across, and that, you know, is just an effect of all the information being transferred into different places. So I think we kind of agree, basically.
Oh no, Jimmy, we can't have the only thing we disagree on be Brexit. Actually, to be completely honest, that's the whole premise of this whole podcast, isn't it?
It is now, yeah.
Yeah.
Do we want to say anything more about William Sitwell?
No.
There was I can't remember who it was that said this on Twitter, and I will stop quoting stuff that I've read on Twitter at some point.
You need to get off Twitter, Jimmy. I've been worried about you. You need to get off Twitter and start doing your job again.
Sorry, mate.
You've been on it so much.
I have problems. but anyway, somebody said, you know, the thing that fascinated the most about this story was how many people were saying that William Sitwell was an amazingly talented journalist, yet somehow he'd been ended up as the editor of a free PR supplement for Waitrose, which
I'm sure it's paid very well.
It probably is paid pretty well. It apparently has a circulation of 650,000.
Yeah, right. It's how many people do actually bloody read that? It's my mum and her mates in the village. They're the only ones who read it.
Right.
And how much influence really is recipes? Is that influence? I don't know.
You're influencing the nation's health.
Yeah, by encouraging them to have a balanced, omnivorous diet.
One can only hope. should we move on to the police?
Oh God, our segues are brilliant this week.
Sorry, it's been a tough week. It's been a tough week. Had you actually heard about this story before I pitched it to you?
Yes, I listened to Radio 4.
Oh dear. Yeah, but you know, further establishing your middle class credentials there.
Yeah, 100%, of course.
The story is that Chief Constable Sarah Thornton said that she thought the police were too stretched to deal with her word deserving issues, including logging hate incidents against women. And she thinks that they should focus more on burglary and other more violent types of crime. Is there anything to disagree with that, Jazza?
Well,
that seems pretty common sense, doesn't it?
I just would quite like it if the police were paid enough to be able to do all of the things that they're meant to do in society. And I think that logging incidents of hate that can then also end up being treated as crimes, as hate crimes, is an important part of policing, because it allows for people to feel safe in their communities. It would be nice if she weren't having to make these kinds of decisions, and if the police were actually funded properly and correctly. I think that she's expressed this in a particularly cack-handed way, and she hasn't. I think that the police perhaps it's no longer fashionable to say just give us more money, or it's not useful for people to say give us more money.
Most public services are asking for more money.
But austerity is over now, I suppose. But what I do take issue to is some of the stuff that you were talking to me with offline, and some of the other stuff around all of this.
Should we define the difference between a hate incident and a hate crime first, because that seems pretty salient to the
discussion. Let's be academic about this and define things.
So a hate crime is a crime, in English law at least, that somebody perceives to have been motivated by prejudice towards a protected characteristic, i.e. ethnicity, or I think sexuality is also a protected characteristic.
Mm-hmm. Gender too.
Gender isn't actually, I don't think, because that's the whole debate around making misogyny a hate crime.
Trans people it is a hate crime.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm not 100% sure about the gender thing, but the rest of it is you know, fairly straightforward, and it has to be an actual crime, i.e. something that is illegal and can result in a conviction of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
Hate incidents are things again that are seemingly motivated by hate, or which the person involved feels to have been motivated by hate, but they're not crimes. So there's I'm reading full facts definition here, and they say, imagine somebody who looks like they're about to break into a house because they're up a ladder, and then when the police arrive, it turns out it was somebody breaking into their own home because they've lost their keys, and that would be an incident because it's something that the police could potentially get called to, but it wasn't a crime. And so non-crime hate incidents, I guess, are things that can be things like antisocial behaviour, and it's things that cause alarm for, you know, say a certain ethnic group, but they're not actually crimes, basically.
Yeah. So, yeah. But the thing is, I think a lot of people will report things not knowing that they are necessarily a crime, but that they are, like, they feel they have been done wrong in some way, shape, or form, right?
Mm.
So, for example, like from personal experience, I've been on the receiving end of what have ended up being defined as hate crimes, a bot of like homophobic abuse on the street, and that does come under the criminal side of things because it's street harassment, and comes under hate crime because it's based on like my sexuality, and what I worry about is that I think it's really important that those kinds of things are first of all documented, and that means that people end up contacting the police with things that end up not being crimes. But how is the ordinary citizen meant to know what is a crime and what isn't? They should just contact the police whenever they feel aggrieved in some way, shape, or form from like maybe an interaction they had with somebody on the street or something.
Wait, really?
Like that.
That's what you think?
Yeah, I think so. Because because if you see that there are a lot of, I mean, for example, the whole thing about misogyny, if you know that an awful lot of online street harassment is happening in a particular area, and that is making life for women in that area particularly bad, then you can focus police resources in a different way to maybe tackle that better, for example.
Some of the information we're talking about, I think, would, you know, be classified as useful police information or useful information for the police to actually gauge what's going on in the area they serve. But I would never report something to the police that wasn't a crime. That seems, I mean, I had a video camera stolen out of my bag a couple of years ago, and I didn't even report that on the basis that I thought the police would have absolutely no chance ever catching the guy.
Didn't you have like insurance and then a need for a police report?
I didn't have insurance actually, but
I always report stuff. I think it's really important, because otherwise you end up having gaps of knowledge. I think you need to give the police as much data as possible so that they can allocate resources effectively and responsibly. And this is kind of like
don't believe that though, because you presumably don't believe that the police should be automatically sent a copy of your browsing history online, for instance.
Is that relevant though?
Well, because that information in aggregate, not yours personally, but everyone's, would potentially be useful to the police.
Yeah, but it would have to be opt-in. Like, this is people deciding, this is something that isn't right in my community, for example. Maybe something that they have experienced or they're reporting another crime. And then that information gets taken in and considered, rather than the police just having access to all information. The citizens would have to decide how that what information gets given to the police, and I think that needs to be in an opt-in basis. And you need to have that active kind of like dialogue with the communities that constables serve in order for you to have kind of like efficient local policing.
I would say I'm not really in favor of the police turning up and kind of approaching people where crime hasn't actually been committed. I think that's this would sort of relate actually to incidents where the police are accused of harassing, say, particularly young black men on the street who aren't actually doing anything, but who somebody somewhere feels there's a potential for a crime to take place, in the immediate future.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that actually falls directly under the very vague term antisocial behaviour. If you have a group of young men hanging around, say, a particular street corner or on a particular street, that is the sort of thing that would be reported as a non-crime incident that is potentially of interest to the police, but in fact they're not doing anything wrong, and the police might well then turn up and cause them some trouble for having not broken the law.
Mm-hmm. But that's where I think I would actually where I disagree with the chief constable. I think that if there is a way of being able to kind of like gather as much information as possible and not just deciding that the one role of the police is for violent incidents, because maybe that's a priority.
I think the primary role of the police is dealing with crime. It's not dealing with things that upset people. They're not necessarily an extension of services.
But also like community support and stuff, I think they are. Like if you have a noisy neighbour, who do you call? Like you don't call 999, but you call like the police station or 101.
You'd call the police over a noisy neighbour?
If somebody's taking the mickey, yeah.
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
That's who you call. You don't like call up the council at 3 a.m. when somebody's having like a rave next door, do you?
No, I suppose not. But if it was a more long-term thing, you probably would call the council, wouldn't you? Isn't that how that works? I don't actually know this.
I guess, yeah. Actually, I think it's a police thing that they're... Like, that's how I would understand it anyway.
Possibly, yeah. But, I mean, this is kind of an argument about where, like, the line is drawn between... I mean, obviously the police deal with actual crime, but for stuff that... is basically, people chafing against one another for whatever reason, but stuff that isn't crime. It's a slightly ambiguous position, really, isn't it?
Yeah, but that is part of the role of the police, I think, to be that, like, a mediating force between citizens sometimes as well. And often it requires a police officer to, turn up to an altercation between two people who've knocked their cards together and just tell them to grow up and calm down and just swap your insurance details. But that is the role, that's one of the many things that the police are supposed to do. The problem is they don't have the resources at the moment and they need more. And if we want them to have that role in society, if we want them to not just be people who investigate crimes, but also these kind of like... people who hold our communities together, then they need more bloody money.
Mm. The trouble from my point of view is the police have been accused in recent years. There's a couple of stories of them, like one of the more infamous ones was when the guy was arrested for tweeting that he was, for joke tweeting that he was going to bomb an airport because his flight had been cancelled or delayed or something. Mm-hmm. This case ended up going to court because I remember Stephen Fry and Al Murray ended up campaigning in this guy's favour. And I'm pretty sure he got off in the end, but the fact that it actually made it to court was kind of incredible. That's obviously a sort of like, phony terrorist incident. Yeah. But you've also got like the Count Dankula case more recently, where this is the Nazi pug video maker, and he ended up being convicted. But he was actually arrested and taken to a cell.
Incredibly. Wasn't he initially arrested? Like the actual arrest happened because of problems he had with his neighbours.
I haven't heard that.
Okay.
I haven't heard that.
Right, don't quote me on that then. I don't know.
He was definitely arrested and he was taken. I mean, obviously, if what you said is true, that puts it in a very different context. But he was definitely convicted on the basis of the video. And I'm just not entirely sure the police can be trusted to take a responsible view on all of these kind of incidents.
All right,
really.
Then whose job is it?
I think to a certain point, you have to say, if a crime's not being committed, it doesn't matter if something annoys you. It just is what it is. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's no way that you can remove all of the friction that takes place in society. And actually, most minor, quarrels between people are kind of just resolved among themselves, and then that's it, really.
I mean, yes. But you need there to kind of, like, be that blurring of the line, because you can't... Normal people aren't going to decide whether or not it's a crime or not.
Presumably all the time. They're like, well, he behaved like an arsehole, but he didn't commit a crime, so I'm not phoning the police over this one.
Yeah, but old women call up the police and report the kids kind of like hanging around looking shifty at the end of their road all the time.
And maybe the police should occasionally say to these old women, look, if they're not committing a crime, we've got other shit to deal with.
But that is what they do.
More polite.
But that is what they do. They don't respond to every single request like that.
Well, isn't this the thing that...
Like, you can call up...
Isn't what Sarah Thornton said basically just a reaffirmation of that? Just saying, we're actually going to focus our resources on dealing with, for want of a better phrase, proper crime that is actually taking place, and we're going to place less emphasis on following up on some of these vaguer reports.
It does take resources to
process all of these, incident reports and all of that sort of thing. It's not something that's free.
Yeah, but then what happens when kind of like these, for example, like a domestic abuse case, if that ends up getting shelved because it's not like a violent... It's not necessarily something that is like on the streets and implicates like a large number of people, and then somebody ends up like losing their life to their partner because, I think you need to have as much hands-on as possible, even with the trivial stuff, to really understand the communities that you're working in as well. I think that's so important.
Well, there is another side to all this, which is that. There's one way of interpreting Sarah Thornton's remarks is that actually they'll end up focusing on the slightly more reactive stuff where crime is actually committed and taking resources away from the more preventative things, which is kind of what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Logging of these incidents can actually save the police money in the long term, or they can, you end up focusing resources preventing stuff rather than just waiting for it to occur and reacting to it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of been a story across a lot of public services throughout the austerity era. So
yeah.
So yeah.
Well, look at us. We just we're solving policing. Great, good for us. shall we wrap up and tell people where to find us? Because I'm hungry. I want to have my dinner.
Fine. That's why you're getting so rowdy.
It is.
You can find me at JDE Nichols on Twitter. But please don't tweet me because I spend too much time on there.
He spends so much time on there. Honestly, Jimmy, I think we need a detox for you. I'll organise one for you. You can find me at Jazza John. Although recently I've been like more of an Instagrammer, so maybe like follow me there.
Where can they find you on Instagram?
Same, Jazza John.
Same, Jazza John. You can find the podcast at Right Dishonor on Twitter. And you can also comment on the website, although nobody does that anymore. So it would be better for us, actually, if you submitted an iTunes review, which does still occasionally happen.
Mm.
Somebody sent us 2 thumbs up recently, which was fun.
Great. What, like in the mail? Some severed digits? What?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. None of our iTunes, obviously.
You can send people thumbs up on iTunes?
Yeah, well, someone did.
Oh, that's exciting. Also, if you're listening to this on Spotify, let us know, because we're on Spotify.
Is that going to be... Have you ever listened to podcasts through Spotify?
No, it's just not a habit for me. But a lot of people do.
Hmm.
Because you can download them as well. Anyway, this is not interesting for the listener. Okay. Yeah, I know, like fancy. Okay, bye everybody. Shut up, Jimmy. Let him go.
Bye.